Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
All right, welcome everyone back to New Books in Education on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ryan Allen, and I'm very excited today to have Dr. Michael S. Roth, who is the current president of Wesleyan University. But I think more importantly for our podcast and our audience, he's also a writer, historian, teacher, educator, and author of Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, from Yale University Press. And I think this book is very nice because it provides sort of a sweeping historical account of important educational thought throughout history. And so I'm really glad to bring just years and years of high-level education historical thought from this particular author. So Dr. Roth, thank you for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
All right. Fantastic. If you could, maybe you can kind of tell our audience sort of how you got to where you're at academically, you know, how you got into education or more history as well. And if you could just maybe go into that a little bit.
Sure. Happy to do it. I did not expect to be going into education, I guess, way back when I was a college student. I was interested in psychopathology and worked in mental hospitals and became interested in philosophy and history and really couldn't quite figure out how to put them together to choose among them. And I was fortunate to have been a student here at Wesleyan in the 70s when a very bold dean said to me, "Well, why choose, man? And why not just continue to follow the things that interest you?" And I kind of ran with that advice. I did go on to get a PhD in history at Princeton, but my first book was in on Freud and psychoanalysis, and my dissertation, that book was based on my senior thesis at Wesleyan, and my dissertation at Princeton was on a history of philosophy and a group of philosophers of history in France in the 20th century. And so I kind of realized at that point when I got my first job in the Claremont Colleges at Scripps College and the Claremont Graduate School in California that I really, my subject was how people make sense of the past. And the whether it was psychology, psychoanalysis, history, philosophy, what interested me was in how people made sense of the past and how they used the past or didn't. In a variety of endeavors. And so at Claremont, I was a professor of history initially. I started there in 1983, just a few years older than my students at the time. And in a few years, I had these two books come out and then was working on another one. And I was named the Hartley Burr Alexander Professor of Humanities, which really allowed me to teach in all the any discipline I wanted, really. And I started teaching in film and philosophy. And I did some work in American history. But the next couple of projects I had to do with, again, how people make sense of the past. I wrote a book about trauma and history, about the construction of memory. I left Claremont to go work at the Getty Center to run a research program there at the think tank they have, the Getty Research Institute. So I'm not an art historian, but I was surrounded by art historians, and I learned a lot from them. And while there, so this would have been in the 90s, I curated a big show on Freud and psychoanalysis from my earlier work at the Library of Congress, and that show traveled all over the world. So I was fortunate to have that kind of experience with the big museums internationally. And while that was happening, I was invited to become president of the California College of the Arts then California College of Arts and Crafts in Oakland and San Francisco. And there again, I remember telling them, I'm not an artist. I think you've got the wrong guy. And they said, no, no. We know about your work. I had written on photography and film. And I didn't know anything about running a school, though. I at the Getty, I gave money away, which is not as easy as it sounds, but it's not all that difficult either. But I went up to the Bay Area. My wife is also an academic, and I was the president of CCA, and it was a great experience. I loved the work; it was very interesting. And at some point while there, Wesleyan asked me if I would come and talk to them about the presidency at Wesleyan. And since Wesleyan had changed my life so dramatically, my parents didn't go to college. I didn't really know anybody who was a professor before I got to college. Wesleyan really so transformed my views of the world that when they asked me to come and talk to them about the presidency, I, of course, couldn't resist. And then when they invited me to be president in 2007, it was very fulfilling. And it's been a wonderfully interesting role to have. I still teach every semester. I teach history and philosophy and occasionally art history at Wesleyan. They let me do that because I guess they have to now that I'm president. I finished a book of essays a few years ago on issues around trauma and memory with a small section on education. And that led me to want to write a book about liberal education, which, of course, is under siege in the United States. And I'm not an American historian. All my work has been in Europe and mostly in France. But I decided to write a book about the American tradition of liberal education because so many of the debates that we're having today about liberal education, I found, were actually debates that were going on in the late 1700s and early 1800s. Mm-hmm. And so my friends in American history heard this with great trepidation that I was going to try to write a book in this field. And I got in touch with the people at Yale. They were interested. And so over the last few years, I've had taken some time in the summer, especially to get some of the research done and to write this short book, Beyond the University.
Yeah, fantastic. And it sounds like, because you have, sort of so many fields that you've been into, I think it probably plays nicely together with this book. You kind of open up the book with your own experience teaching, which I think is important. And you talk about sort of some of the things that are changing with today's education. And specifically, one thing that we're all, I think, trying to grapple with, trying to figure out, are MOOCs, massively open online courses. Can you maybe talk about your experience with MOOCs and sort of how does it fit into the idea of liberal education?
Well, I don't think that liberal education depends on the field you're teaching or that you're learning, nor do I think it necessarily depends on the size of the class you're in. And so I think it does depend on having an open, contextual, and conceptual approach to whatever subject matter you're engaging in. Mm-hmm. I've taught a couple of MOOCs now in partnership with Coursera. And the first is a kind of classic humanities course. I call it a good enough books course. Most of it would have been called a great books course in the old days. Called The Modern and the Postmodern. We start with Immanuel Kant and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and we end in the present with Richard Rorty and Judith Butler and Bruno Latour. So the course every week it's a different author and. There's no way in the world that a course like this, which I've been teaching on campuses the last 15 years, I guess, in one form or another, there's no way a class like this wouldn't be thought of as a liberal arts class or a course in liberal education when you give it on campus. Mm-hmm. And lately, because I'm the president and I teach large classes, I've given this class for six graduate students, at different times, but I've also now give it to about 100 people every time I teach it. So it occurred to me, why wouldn't it work if I gave it to several thousand people? Mm. And, you know, one answer would be, well, of course, they can't talk back to you. That's not a bad answer. They can't ask me questions directly while I'm speaking. Because I don't ever lecture. I talk with my class like I'm talking to you. And so with Coursera, we constructed a class that, although it has video lectures, which don't change, they're the same. After every lecture, there are possibilities for students to interact with one another via discussion boards and exchange their papers and exchange their ideas. And then we also have Google Hangouts where students win the right to have an ongoing discussion with the professor, with me, and then that gets broadcast to everyone. And now there's a new thing we have called Talkabouts, which allows students to sign up for discussion sessions automatically, and they join other students in discussion sessions. Mm-hmm. And so although it's different from teaching on campus, it didn't seem to me that difference had anything to do with the goals of Google Education. I still want them to learn critical and creative thinking. I still want them to be absorbed in great works of literature and art. I still show them the slides of the painters or the architects. We still read Virginia Woolf and try to understand what that book has to teach us about its own time and ours. So the fact that it's big doesn't seem to compromise the learning goals that I have for the class. It's not a seminar. That would be quite different. But I don't think anyone has really argued that the only way to have liberal education is in a seminar. I do think that's a preferable way. I mean, it's very expensive, and you're only interacting with 10 people at a time, or 20 perhaps. But if you're going to have a class with, I don't know what the number is, 50, 75 people, why not have a class? Take that class and make it much bigger, if you can ensure possibilities for discussion and conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, the real weakness in the model so far is that, unlike my class at Wesleyan and other places I've taught, they're not being graded by the professor or by TA. They're getting comments on their papers from other students. Mm. And it's true that's really variable. It's not so much about the grades, because at places like Wesleyan or the Claremont Colleges or the Ivy League schools, everybody gets an A, apparently. So it's not about grades, but it's about the quality of the feedback you get. And I do have students in my class, the modern and postmodern, who, some of the feedback they've gotten has not been that helpful. And that's something they're still trying to design solutions to. But I think that's a small price to pay for having the experience of being in a class with people who have PhDs, people who are in middle school, people who are in Bangladesh, people who are in New York, people who are in Nairobi, people who are in Buenos Aires. And that's an incredible opportunity for students to interact with one another around the world. I have students from 100 different countries in that class, mm-hmm. and they can interact with one another. Now, it is also true I had professors in that class who have PhDs in the fields that we're talking about, and their papers would be graded by a middle school student for whom English might be her third language. They're not going to get the greatest feedback that way. But what we did to solve that problem, or at least to address it, was to say that when you write a short paper on Flaubert, when you send it in, you get feedback from 5 different people. Mm-hmm. And so if 2 of those folks are giving you good feedback, I think it's a winning proposition. Mm-hmm. But to even make it a little bit more beneficial, we offer to all our students the opportunity to post their papers on the course's website and get feedback from whoever wanted to read the work. Mm-hmm. So it's much more collective and enterprise than most of my lecture classes have been. So, when I teach the class at Wesleyan, the student hands me the paper and gets comments back from me or from my assistant, but no one else in the class knows what they've written. In this MOOC, everybody can see is the papers of those who post them. So, you know, it's still an experiment. I mean, I've had a couple of 100,000 students sign up for my classes in the last 2 years. That's an incredible little number for a guy who, like me, who's taught at small places. But only, you know, a very small percentage of those people actually do all the work. They don't sign up intending to do all the work. A small percentage of them will do all the work, will hand in papers, will get their assignments on time, will do the reading. Mm-hmm. But for me, even though that's just a handful, that's thousands of people. Mm-hmm. And if I can help thousands of people have greater access to Nietzsche and Flaubert and Baudelaire and Horkheimer and Adorno, that sounds pretty cool to me. That does seem to me like liberal education.
Right, right. And it's certainly great, maybe a modern example of some of these sort of older philosophies that you sort of talk about throughout the book. And if you want, maybe just we can start to go into the first chapter or after the introduction, which you title From Taking the World to Transforming the Self. And you open up with one of the United States founding fathers, you know, Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, yeah, he's very famous for his education stance, which may have been different from some of the other founding fathers. But can you kind of go into what his conception of education is? And then if you want at the end, you can kind of talk a little bit about some of the criticisms, especially if you're thinking of the African Americans or the slave population who were in the United States then as well.
Sure. So, you know, Jefferson was an Enlightenment guy, and so he really has a theory of education that comes out of the 18th century Enlightenment, especially in the English-speaking world. And but his decisive intervention in the U.S. was to create in the University of Virginia school that would be not only geared to science and inquiry, but would be geared to science and inquiry in such a way as to promote the free choice of the students who were enrolled therein. Mm-hmm. By which I mean, Jefferson thought that most schools, when you began, they slotted you into a field of study that predetermined how what the things you would learn and what you would do when you graduated. He wanted to create instead a school that would allow you to choose what you're going to do on the basis of what you were learning rather than the basis of who your parents were or and what they set out for you to do. That the inquiry itself would lead you to make choices that would lead to further inquiry and make other choices. And that all subjects that could be employed in the world should be taught at the university. That is, these should be subjects of live discussion and not just rote memorization. And so, Jefferson felt that it was absolutely crucial to have these institutions because otherwise, the people would, through their ignorance, be more likely to be oppressed by people with power, money, and by the government. So in addition to creating an academic environment based on choice and scientific inquiry, he thought it was very important that the country find ways to finance the education of those people without the means to do so themselves. He didn't succeed in this regard to the extent he wanted. That is, it takes more taxes. Mm. And in Virginia in his day, just like in most states in our day, they were loath to pay for the education of their young citizens. He regarded that, and I think he was absolutely right, as a grave mistake. Because what you would get is that people who were dominating society at the time would ensure that their own progeny got the advantages, and the most talented people might be left by the wayside because they never had access to these education. And then he thought you would get basically an unnatural aristocracy, that is, people with power and could dominate, but who were pretty stupid. And you would not allow the kind of rejuvenation of society by giving those people with talent, not everybody has endowed with talents in the same way, but giving those people with talent the ability to actualize their talents mm-hmm. through education. So Jefferson, so in that sense, he took a very democratic view of education as both that you should have access to education if you had the talents, and also that access to education would be a way for the citizens to protect themselves against the tyranny of bureaucracy and government. Mm-hmm. Now, the criticism, of course, was that Jefferson had a very limited notion of who could be talented. Mm-hmm. And so women were compromised, in his view, by their gender. Indian Native Americans were somewhat compromised as well. And then, of course, African Americans, he did not think would have the capacity for this. And what I found very interesting was that even in the kind of middle of the 1800s, before the Civil War, that African-American writers used a Jeffersonian rhetoric to critique Jefferson. So David Walker, for example, who writes this extraordinary pamphlet about how slaves have to rebel, really, have to stand up for themselves and through education overturn their masters, his rhetoric against the Jeffersonian racism is completely Jeffersonian. That is, education will allow people of talent to protect the citizenry against tyranny and will allow people with talent to rise to the appropriate heights. Education for Walker was absolutely key. And Frederick Douglass writes his autobiography. He is a great critic of American racism. He has his fantastic 4th of July speech. About white people declaring their independence while they hold slaves, mm-hmm. is a scorching indictment of American racism. Yet he too used as a kind of Jeffersonian rhetoric about the power of education to unslave you, right? To unslave you, to set you free, and that led me to Emerson eventually, for whom also education sets you free. But what he meant by setting you free was less getting just rid of concrete slavery and less protecting you against the government, but setting you free by setting you, giving you the permission, ability to be apart from the herd, from the common crowd. With Ralph Waldo Emerson, who I write about it at some length in that chapter, education should give you the possibility for self-transformation. He said that colleges do their work when they incite young souls of flame, and that we learn to animate the world through education. Education should make you self-reliant, but not just economically, politically, but make you self-reliant existentially and spiritually. This is a belief in education that is profound. But it's a belief in education as a vehicle for not conforming to the status quo. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very American. The European traditions of liberal arts have a lot to do with putting you in a place, putting you in a niche. The American views of liberal education really had to do with setting you free one way or another. I thought that was very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that... You start talking about the European style of education. Moving along right to the next chapter, pragmatism from autonomy to recognition. You do talk about sort of the German education and some of the people or thinkers, W.B. Du Bois for one, who had sort of this experience over in Germany. I really like that chapter as someone who's interested in sort of international education and exchange specifically. I think it was very insightful. Can you kind of talk about his experience there and what sort of that meant and how it
Yeah, you know, Du Bois is a great figure, as is Jane Addams, who I also talk about in this chapter, both of whom go to Europe and in some ways reject European models but learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Du Bois is fascinating. I mean, he goes to Europe as an African-American. He is treated with a different kind of condescension in Europe than he would be by the kind of overt racism, the violent racism that you experience in the United States, especially when he was in the South. But what he also experienced in Berlin and even before he went to Berlin and Harvard was what was happening in American education in the second half of the 19th century was that the research university was growing and growing as a vehicle for specialization.
Mm-hmm.
And so specialization becomes the sign of sophistication in American elite universities in the late 1800s and throughout the 20th century, really. And I think that the specialization was allowed the research university to tie the sciences and the social sciences to concrete needs that that the countries had or the economy had, but it also had a great tension with liberal education because specialization might result in the people at one part of the university or the college having great expertise but being completely incapable of talking to people from another part of the college. And so you graduate specialists who really could have very little capacity to translate their own thinking, their own ways of knowing for other kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pragmatists, I think Du Bois is certainly influenced by them. I write about William James. I write about Jane Addams. They were interested in a form of education, though it might lead you deeply into a single subject, would return you to the tasks at hand in the public sphere. Mm-hmm. Return you to the tasks at hand of citizens, neighbors, of people who were just working together in society. And for them, education was setting you free, but it was setting you free to work with others at tasks that matter to people. And the danger they saw was that you could graduate people who were really good at something that nobody else cared about and had no relevance to society. And they wanted to make sure that the universities and colleges were giving their students the ability to think broadly, to act effectively, and to take on responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the pragmatism enters the picture for me in its insistence that knowledge is really a habit of action,
mm-hmm.
and a habit of action should be judged by its effects,
mm-hmm.
by what it makes happen in the world, and it's not about its corresponding to an ideal or even to reality. It's about its effects in the world. And so what I argue for, as you know, in the last chapter of the book, is what I call pragmatic liberal education, a liberal education that shows its stuff by what you can do in the world. Now, what you can do might be to play the violin very well or to write poetry or to create a design company. I mean, it could be or manufacturing institute. No matter. What matters is that the ways of knowing at the university, at college, but can be translated into the problems and opportunities that are significant for people who don't live at the university.
Mm, right.
And that's why I've entitled this book Beyond the University, because I have, now, myself having spent almost my entire adult life at colleges and universities, except while I was at the Getty, what we teach here, what people learn here, shouldn't be judged just on the satisfaction they have with being at college. It should be judged by what they can do with it when they get out. Du Bois said education is empowerment. And so when people leave the university, and most people do, right, unlike myself and my colleagues at the faculty,
right.
Most people leave the university,
right?
But they should leave by being empowered by ways of knowing and habits of action. I do think that pragmatic liberal education is something that has served us well in this country for a long time, and that we have to protect it against those who would, you know, argue for a much more narrow instrumentality, or against that to a kind of effete sophistication, neither of which will serve our country in the future.
Right, right. And I like in this chapter, you kind of open up with this nice question, how relevant is it to talk citizenship and aversive thinking to students who first and foremost are desperate to escape from poverty? I think it's, you know, a great sort of setup for at least even, you know, talking about modern thoughts on this kind of thing, which
definitely
interjected there, certainly.
Absolutely. That was the debate between Booker T. Washington and Du Bois.
Mm-hmm.
Washington said, hey, look, it's very nice to talk about empowerment and aversive thinking and freedom, but these guys need to earn a living. And mm-hmm. as you say, today, that is what a lot of people are wondering. You know, okay, all this highfalutin rhetoric of a university president, but
right.
people have to make a living. And I do think it's very important that we give students empowerment, which includes being able to support yourself, but it shouldn't be reduced to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if reduced to that, then we will have the result of unimaginative and anti-egalitarian approach to a life after the university.
Right. Well, I think that definitely moves us into the next chapter, Controversies and Critics. And again, I love sort of the historical narrative sprinkled throughout, talking about Benjamin Franklin. And what was why was Benjamin Franklin so sort of not anti, but maybe critical of Harvard or these other elite institutions, you know, writing in and under fake pen names, lampooning these places? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, Ben Franklin, you know, he plays an important role in this story. I mean, there's this new book out called Excellent Sheep, right, that is about how Ivy League schools just, you know, train us to become docile members of a herd who don't have anything creative to do in the world. This is really what Ben Franklin was saying. You know, he said about Harvard students, they learn how to walk out of a drawing room or something like that. Or you learn how to drop names at a cocktail party. You know, it's that
right.
it's that kind of critique that higher education has become a finishing school for the rich.
Mm.
Whether you learn how to cheer at a squash match or drink with the fraternity guys or drop names with the artists and the theorists. That for Franklin wasn't what education should be about. Education mm-hmm. should be about giving you more capacity to make a difference in the world. So Franklin was very critical of the kind of finishing school side of elite education. But at the same time, he started a reading group. He started a book club. He starts the University of Pennsylvania. He's a friend of liberal education who worries that the institutions that go under the name of higher education are losing their mission and chasing either the almighty dollar or the allure of sophistication.
Right. In fact, I actually just interviewed the author of Excellent Sheep, and that should be coming out in the next couple of days on the New Books in Education podcast, Bill DeResowitz. So
yes.
glad you mentioned him. I guess moving along in this book, you kind of get into a section talking about sort of the growth or change in sort of what we call it, women's education. Specifically, talk about Smith College, Vassar, and Wellesley, and some other universities. So, what was sort of the conception, and how was that different than maybe thinking before for women's education?
Well, I part of what happens is that these women's colleges spring up to provide access to higher education for ambitious young women, and they, because of the traditional colleges and universities, most of which were closed to women.
Mm-hmm.
Wesleyan, for example, opened its doors to women in the last quarter of the 19th century, mm-hmm. but then kicked the women out in 14 or so, because they thought that they interrupted the manly sense of community that the universities required. So women's colleges filled this void, and they also expanded the curriculum in certain ways, especially towards the arts and towards the in some ways, the traditional liberal arts fields became, you might say, feminized. That is, Smith College, Mount Holyoke, and then later Scripps College out west, where I used to teach, they became real centers for the humanities and for classics. Whereas, you know, in the mid-1800s, professors of Greek would say, a woman can't learn Greek, it's impossible. You know, by the 1920s, if you kick the women out of the classics department, there wouldn't be many people left in them. And so women's colleges play this really important role in preserving a certain approach to humanities learning and providing access to empowerment for generations of women. And they still do play that role, I think. You know, there's a small group today in women's colleges, but they still play this role for lots of women for whom the experience of learning side by side with other women is extraordinarily empowering.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe you already kind of mentioned specialization a little bit, and this chapter kind of chronicles some moments in history and kind of tells us, like, why did we start moving in this direction or why did we start seeking it out? I know especially you talk about one point about Sputnik, which is an interesting correlation to this. So can you kind of talk about some of those moments in history that have sort of pushed us in that direction?
Well, the first is in the late 19th century with the research university trying to emulate the German research seminar, and that's, you know, well documented, and the collegiate ideal in the early 20th century pushes back against that to have a well-rounded student. But in the wake of the Second World War and the demand of industry and science, there is a drive to ensure that American competitiveness is enhanced through investment in the sciences and specialized research that brought together can build on one another. And so the research university grows ever more powerful, and even colleges and even liberal arts colleges emulate the recognition given to faculty that is a standard in research universities. So by that I mean that at the big research universities, in order to get ahead as a faculty member, you had to publish for your peers, for people in your field, and then for your subfield, and then for your sub-subfield. And if you did really well, you would get accolades, you get raises, you get tenure, you get promotion. All of that is very important to the research university. But by the 1960s, this has become important throughout colleges in the United States. Seeking prestige means seeking publication. Seeking publication occurs through specialization. Mm-hmm. So the well-rounded professor is seen increasingly as anti-professional, a little bit of a dilettante, and that really falls out of favor. And you see this in the social sciences and the humanities, each discipline promoting a specialized language. In the humanities, when I was in graduate school and a young faculty member, you know, this happened through theory, right, through literary theory and deconstruction and then postmodernism, developing a whole language that was incomprehensible to people outside of that specialization. But if you could learn to speak it well, you got the rewards such as they are from the academic community. And I think that this is hard to avoid. Every organization goes through these kinds of routinization and specialization. I think that's part of how organizations mature. But what we have to make sure happens at colleges and universities that care about undergraduate teaching is that the people who are teaching undergraduates realize that they are not producing clones of themselves. This is what Bill's book, I think, really focuses on, mm-hmm. is that so many faculty teach their students as if their students were going to become faculty. yet they know they're not going to become faculty. Right. There's no room for them to become faculty. What they should be learning are the things that Jefferson and Franklin and Emerson and Du Bois and Jane Addams thought were important, the kinds of empowering educational experiences that lead you to lifelong learning beyond the university.
Absolutely.
Graduation. But to do that, the reward system for faculty have to change. Or we have to make sure that we have faculty who can produce specialized research, but also could teach in a classroom and translate the research into other terms. Mm-hmm. That's a big word for me, translate. Because I do think that you do make progress in science and in other fields through specialization. I mean, I do think that, you know, you learn something deeper by studying something at great length. But we need those people to also be able to translate their knowledge to undergraduates who are not going to follow them into that narrow area, but will want to understand how that narrow area can be made relevant to their own thinking. I was lucky to have professors like this when I was an undergraduate, and even in graduate school, professors who knew as much as anyone in the world about their specific subject, but who taught their students in such a way as to translate that specific expertise into experiences that made a difference to us, given the issues we were facing in our own lives as individuals and then out in the world of politics as citizens.
Right, right. And as someone who is looking to break into academia in a few years, and actually already, and I teach undergraduate courses, you know, something that I hope that I can, you know, give to my students as well. So definitely a nice lesson for us.
I use this phrase sometimes, intellectual cross-training. You have to be able, you know, if you're an academic, I mean, I've written books on French Hegelianism. It's pretty specialized. And I still write, you know, for psychoanalytic journals from time to time. And I think that's important, and I enjoy that kind of work. At the same time, you know, writing a book like Beyond the University, I am trying to reach a different audience. Mm-hmm. Standing in front of my students at Wesleyan or the thousands, you know, online, I'm trying to communicate something essential about whatever the text is, let's say Flaubert, but I'm trying to do so in a way that matters not to you because you're a Flaubert scholar, but to you because you're a person who's facing disillusionment and romantic disappointment, whatever it is, or betrayal. And the, being able to do both, I think, is really important. And I think at many schools, there are faculty who are doing both, who are consistently working in their own field, but also able to reach undergraduates at a general level.
Right, right. Fantastic. And just, I guess, wrapping up the book, the final chapter, Reshaping Ourselves and Our Society, our societies, you open up with John Dewey, and you talk about this Deweyan perspective. You know, I'm sitting here at Columbia University Teachers College, so, you know, there's a statue of him down the street or down the hall from me. So can you kind of talk about why he's important to this educational movement and what sort of his that perspective is?
Well, you know, Dewey was the most thoughtful philosopher in education ever in the United States. And he was able to communicate the importance of a broad education, developing specific skills while at the same time empowering students to make choices in the world after graduation. So he recognized very much that, you know, people have to get jobs after college. Now, that would not be a shock to him that we want to make sure people can get jobs. He wasn't thinking they should just be able to talk about philosophy or literature or chemistry after graduation. They need to work. But he also thought, as Jefferson did, that we shouldn't choose their professions before they're done learning, that we have to give them a wide variety of skills so that they can go off and find the kind of meaningful work that that will enable them to be self-sufficient. So Dewey, for me, is absolutely crucial. He's also a philosopher who, unlike these guys today who talk about, oh, it's a shame the cab driver has a PhD or the bartender was a chemistry major, You know, for Dewey, that's a great thing, that we have citizens there who actually know lots of things. It's an important thing. Not just professors should know things. Not just politicians should know things. Having an educated citizenry capable of continuing to learn on their own is an absolutely vital piece of democracy. I came to Dewey from my teacher, Richard Rorty, at Princeton, and as I came to all these pragmatists, really, through Rorty. And I think that, you know, what Rorty emphasized in Dewey and in the others was that language isn't a mirror of reality. Language is a tool we use to do things in the world. And the same thing is true for me of education. It's not a mirror of reality. It's not supposed to be something that reflects the world. It's a tool for us to have an impact on the world and to make it a better place for ourselves and the beings with whom we share it. And so that chapter allows me to talk about Dewey. I had talked about James earlier in the book. And then in the end, Richard Rorty and Martha Nussbaum and a few others who are really focused on liberal education as an essential aspect of the American culture and economy today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And you kind of close off the chapter with this story again, you know, maybe bookending from another teaching perspective where you actually went to China. And
yeah.
Can you kind of tell me how that tied into your liberal education?
Well, it's very nice of you to focus on the fact that the bookends of this volume are about teaching, because I do think of myself mostly as a teacher, and I've been doing since the early 80s. And I was invited to China to talk about liberal education at the Institute for Humanities at Peking University. And I say in the book, I expected there would be 20 people there. It was during their vacation at school and everything. And the place was packed. Questions were great. People were really interested in what the Chinese call education of the whole person. Mm-hmm. By which they mean, don't educate an appendage, just a code piece of you that writes code, or just the piece of you that does mathematics, or the little part of you that is interested in linguistics. We want an education of the whole person so that you have an integrated approach to learning and an integrated approach to living. I had thought that, you know, the Chinese were so invested in test-taking and a meritocracy based on exams that this notion, and very narrowly contrived exams, that they would be less hospitable to liberal education. But right now, there's a great move in China to stimulate more creativity, create more innovation, and so they are starting liberal arts colleges and universities. So I think that this notion of vigorous, aversive thinking, which would be, of course, a change for the Chinese regime today, based in higher education and learning from a variety of perspectives, which serve them well, and I think it's really important for us in America, because it serves us well to maintain the ecosystem of learning that liberal education has developed here for the last almost 200 years.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, great. I mean, if you could, I want to know, you know, what's next? You just got, you know, done writing this book. What's next for you?
Well, I have a couple of other projects in mind. You know, I am the president of the university, so it takes a little bit of time to do that. But I have a few things that I'm working on. I have something on psychoanalysis and history coming out. So I continue to work in these other fields. I still write a lot of op-eds and, you know, book reviews and newspapers. And I do believe playing a public role is important for professors and for university presidents. But I am very interested and have been for a long time in what I call in this book the dialectic between reverence and critique. Mm. And Bruce Kimball writes about this in his work on liberal education, but that, you know, on the one hand, you want people to pay attention to the great works of the past. On the other hand, you really want them to develop into critical thinkers. And I've been thinking about another book project that would explore the interaction of these two streams of thinking, the one that goes toward reverence, what I called in my earlier works piety, and the other one that goes towards inquiry and critique and even deconstruction. So I'm not sure how that will come out yet. I have another MOOC that I've taught called How to Change the World, which is basically talking to experts about global problems, and people have asked me if I would turn that into a book. But meanwhile, I have my day job, so that's kind of busy.
Certainly. Well, we'll look forward to that. And until then, what we have this book here, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. I just want to thank Dr. Michael Roth for coming to join New Books in Education. And this is your host, Ryan Allen. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I hope you learned something.
Thanks very much, Ryan.